I'm Roger Wendell, and with me in the studio today is Dr. Penelope Kanaan, environmental sociologist at Denver University's Department of Sociology and Criminology. Dr. Kanaan is on a 2-year leave of absence to participate in the Global Carbon Project at the National Institute of Environmental Studies in Tsukuba, Japan. Dr. Kanaan, welcome to KGNU.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start from the very beginning. Tell us about global warming. Where are we at? Where did we come from?
Well, of course, that's a huge topic, so let's kind of break it down. The Earth is the only planet that supports life as we know it. As you know, it's a rare planet. I think that's easy to agree on. And part of the reason that we are able to exist in such a nice situation is that we have greenhouse gases. We have methane, water vapor, and carbon dioxide, making us warm for hundreds of thousands of years. In fact, about 59 degrees warm on average. And that has been the case for hundreds of thousands of years, and that's partly because of the carbon cycle. Carbon dioxide comes from the atmosphere. It is transformed by plants into oxygen, and then carbon is produced as it grows. We eat carbon, and in the form of carbohydrates, and then when plant life dies. An animal life dies, the carbon is released again into carbon dioxide in this marvelous grand cycle called the global carbon cycle. So for hundreds of thousands of years, the balance in the release and production of carbon and carbon dioxide has meant that we've been operating at about 290 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And then in the Industrial Revolution, during that time, the revolution was about finding that there were fuels that we could burn for all sorts of wonderful applications in transportation and industrialization and urbanization, and that those fossil fuels were essentially fuels that were compacted old carbon. And they were fossilized from millions of acres of forests and animals, and including oceanic life that had become carbonized. Well, just since the Industrial Revolution, that is in about 250 years, we've not only increased our population from 1 billion people to more than 6 billion people, but we've also increased the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from the steady level. We've increased it by about 33%. And that's meant that there's more greenhouse gases, these methane, carbon dioxide, water vapor, and the like. So the effect of these gases in the atmosphere and having a greater concentration means a greater greenhouse effect. So if you can think of a greenhouse, it just gets hotter and steamier. So in the course of just 100 years, the past 100 years, the carbon emissions that we had emitted several hundred years ago have finally reached a level of this 33% greater, so that we're now have warmed the globe on the only 1 degree a centigrade increase. So we have global warming. Now, by this point, since carbon dioxide has a shelf life of about 100 years,
What do you mean by that, a shelf life of 100 years?
Well, that means that if you emit carbon today, it won't be gone from the atmosphere and into the full cycle of things for another 100 years.
But the carbon molecules themselves stay intact indefinitely.
That's right. Okay. It's a closed system, really. So it means now that we're predicting that instead of 1 degree increase in temperature in 100 years, we're anticipating about 1 degree change every decade from now on.
So in essence, we've been basically in what I would call maybe carbon equilibrium, if that's an appropriate term, up until the time of the industrial age. And it's at that point when the population increased and we started using more combustibles that things started to deteriorate, as it were, or the carbon content in the atmosphere is increasing. Is that a fair analysis?
That's absolutely correct. That is, we had a balanced system, and it was a geosphere, biosphere, atmosphere balance. And now people are talking about the human dimensions, because it's human beings who have settled in cities and urbanized, industrialized, and been burning these fossil fuels, that now the human dimensions of this cycle are equally important as drivers of our planetary condition. So Paul Crutzen, who's a Nobel laureate chemist, suggests that this era, this geologic era, be named the Anthroposphere.
Meaning affected by human beings.
Exactly. One species is affecting the entire planetary condition of that under which we will live from now on.
And I want to talk about, in just a moment, the significance of this 1 degree per decade increase that you've talked about here. But let's back up just a moment. You hold a PhD in sociology.
Correct.
How do sociologists fit into this picture of addressing a global warming problem, something maybe a layperson such as myself would consider a hard science problem? How do the two relate?
Well, obviously, in one sense, if human beings have caused this problem, it is human beings and their social behavior that needs to be understood. So what is it about the way we live our lives and the way we the different patterns of social life around the world, which have different impacts on the world that need to be understood. Simultaneously, we as social groups, the physical conditions of where we live also impact us, whether we live in deserts or mountains, alpine, or whether we live in river systems, where we locate, I mean, or whether we are freezing in the winter or whether we're in the, you know, tropical paradise, the way we build our homes and live our lives and travel and all sorts of things are much, very much an interaction between this social being, these social creatures, human beings, and the physical environment. So that it's the reality that it is an earth system that holds us as well. And the phenomenal thing is that human beings are so powerful in this earth system that we have to understand how human beings work, the most complicated and complex animals on the earth, how we have organized ourselves. So the environmental sociology is only about 40 years old as a subdiscipline within sociology. And it sociology sort of thinks of itself as the generalist, that we have to understand economics and geography and psychology and history. But it's understanding how human beings organize themselves in social groups and make social decisions and the social patterns that they have. So it's fascinating about how it is that we interact with nature.
And that's real good. We're going to save that piece, but we have to pause here because you're popping your peas and I've been controlling it.
Oh.
But it's okay. And it has
Shall
to
we say that again?
No. You did fine because I was... What happens is when we speak directly into a microphone, we get more of a...
I see.
I
can also move the chair.
Well, about 6 inches from you, and not aiming directly into your speech, something like that. Much experience here in these tapings.
That's pretty good. Okay. And maybe to the side like this?
Yeah, to the side is much better. You were kind of speaking like that, which is okay until you pop your peas.
Okay.
So this taping is great. I mean, you take these huge pauses and correct errors.
Yeah, right.
So that makes a lot of sense about the way sociologists are addressing this problem of global warming. But is there, would it be fair to say there's a collaboration at this point between the sociologists and the climatologists? Is it an ongoing effort working together?
That's a great question. Let me first respond by saying that it's not only sociologists. Let me suggest that it's the social sciences, including all those, the economists and the geographers, historians, anthropologists, geographers, that are all, their expertise is, all of that expertise is necessary to understand the relationship between human societies and nature. In addition, in response to that question, typically since the Enlightenment, we've been organizing our disciplines very strictly. You know, this is chemistry, this is biology, this is physics, this is sociology, this is history. And what is now apparent more than ever, and certainly in the field of environmental questions, is that no one science could possibly answer all of the, provide all the answers, scientific answers anyway. And so there is now essentially a rapidly growing appreciation of a new way to think scientifically and to conduct our science that is integrative, synthetic, and cooperative, collaborative. And it's not easy. It's, a whole new vocabulary, or at least when someone talks about parameterizing global models, or we ought to be using GCMs, general circulation models, we have to pause and say, wait a minute, in my field, this a climate regime is a physical thing, not an international treaty. And a physical thing like what is the weather or the climate pattern and its cycle. And so in the year 2001, four very powerful international scientific communities got together to express their dissatisfaction with how we had organized science. In a sense, not that it could not serve society as well if it were so organized so strictly disciplinarily. And these four scientific communities included the geospheric, biospheric scientists, the atmospheric scientists at the World Climate Research Program, the human dimensions of global change scientific community, and Diversitas, which is the biodiversity science, or the biologists. And they signed the Amsterdam Declaration of 2001, something you can go to the web and Google on the Amsterdam Declaration, in which they said that we must have integrated science, and we must integrate science with policy decisions. That is, we must make the science on global warming, we must make it policy relevant. We don't want to make the policy decisions as scientists, but we want to make sure that we are striving to answer the questions that policymakers, decision makers at every level of society and around the world, what do they need from science and integrated earth system science? What do they need from science to make informed decisions? They have other things to consider, of course, pressures and competition with other issues, but we, as the sciences, we need to give them our best, and our best needs to step up to the plate in an integrated way, no matter how difficult that is.
Is it fair to say then at this point that most scientists, most disciplines are in agreement with what's actually taking place and why it's taking place and the severity of the issue? The reason I ask this is you've been out of the country for a couple of years, and you may not know that there are some popular figures up until recently as a year or two ago that were suggesting that this is not caused by human activity. Rush Limbaugh comes to mind, for example, and others have suggested that this is questionable science. So my question for you is science in general in agreement as to the severity of the situation at this point?
There is absolutely no doubt that science agrees that the Earth is warming, has warmed, and will continue to warm due to the activities of human beings. There is, of course, science is the most skeptical field there is. We have to convince ourselves, and then we always are ending with, but there are always other questions to do. So research and skepticism and never proving, but always seeking new information. Never proving for in a final way. We always open the doors to there could be new information. Is the cornerstone of the scientific mind. So there are a few people who are what we might call climate change, global warming, science skeptics. We know from research in the social sciences that those skeptics are paid for, they are supported by lobbying interests that are related to fossil fuels. We call them the carbon barons. But they do not publish in peer-reviewed scientific journals. They are not respected scientists. So they're sort of politicized this debate when it's a time when to politicize this is to make it is to trivialize the severity of the problem, and to be very simplistic. Science wants to do science and doesn't, and the Earth doesn't care whether or not there's a political craziness that's going on, but there's no doubt in science about what has happened. There's certainly doubt about the future. No scientist is clairvoyant, but our predictions, which are based, I don't know if somebody tells me there's a 99.999% chance it will rain tomorrow, I'm likely to take an umbrella. And that's where we are, is not that we know, the data are obvious that the Earth has warmed in 1 year, in 1 century. We know that. That's fact. And whether we don't know how much it will warm, we're predicting about 1 degree centigrade every 10 years. But we could be wrong. We could be surprised. It could be 2 degrees next decade, 3 degrees the next, because there are non-linearities we're talking about, and there are surprises. And very importantly, this Earth has not been in this state in history, as far back as we can measure. And so we don't have it. We're in what the scientists call a non-analog state. There's no condition comparable. We have no historical records to compare. So we are saying we're predicting 1 degree global average, but what if it's 1.1? That's where our doubt comes in. What if it's a 1.1 degree change? What if it's a 1.2? You see, so there's scientific debate going on, but it's not about whether or not this has happened and happening.
Now, apparently, the Earth in the past has been extraordinarily warm or hot. What we're questioning now is the rate of change.
That's correct. Not just that. The last time, I believe, now I'm a sociologist, so I better, there are lots of papers and scientific books about this, but the last time it was this way, I think there were not human beings, certainly not the sorts of settlements that we live in now. We had such dramatic change on the Earth that we lost half of the plant life. We can say, oh yeah, okay, maybe a billion years ago it was sort of like this. And if I don't know about you, but I don't think that I want to live in those conditions. So it's more a question of our own survival as a species.
If you've just tuned in, I'm Roger Wendell, and my guest today is Dr. Penelope Kanaan, environmental sociologist at Denver University's Department of Sociology and Criminology, and we're talking about global warming. Dr. Kanaan, I'd like to get a little more information from you about the Global Carbon Project and the work you're doing in Japan, but before that, let's get into what would be considered maybe the gory details, this 1 degree, 1.5, 2 degree increase every decade or so. What does that actually mean? What's taking place as a result of this rapid increase in temperature?
Well, when you think of sort of the major systems of the Earth, we have the hydrologic system, that's the water that's going, you know, from ocean to clouds to rain to snow, all those sorts. If you think about the geologic time period, I mean, the geologic change, where all of those are affected by the temperature of the globe. And one of the major obvious current effects of this is the warming at the poles of our glaciers. And, for example, there's not going to be snows on Kilimanjaro anymore, I mean, very soon.
I've heard as recently as 2012, actually, they'll uh-huh. be completely gone.
Right. So we know that we don't know exactly what that's going to mean. We haven't been on the Earth to understand how that's going to make. But we do know that water has to go somewhere. And it goes both into the oceans. So they're talking sea level rise, which may be the most significant or dramatic change. We also know that warm water is larger than cool water. So the oceans would rise. We also know that that means more water in our atmosphere so that our storms, will have more water in them and be at larger systems. So in terms of climate patterns, we anticipate much more, or weather patterns, we anticipate much more severe weather systems and more frequent severe weather systems. Now, in some parts of the world, this may mean droughts, and whereas other parts it may be floods. It may be a 90 degree, 90 degrees where it's never been 90 degrees in that week in history. You know, the earliest spring we've ever had. And so we do know that we mean a lot about the change just from warmth and water. And when you think about how important weather is to commerce, transportation, recreation, tourism, growing crops, what isn't affected by the weather, then we can't exactly predict because we're better globally than we are regionally. But we do know this is already happening in terms of changes in hydrologic systems and weather patterns.
With these changes in the hydrologic cycle, is it possible there could be occurring opposite effects? Maybe, for example, here along what we call Colorado's Front Range, the Denver-Boulder area, maybe an increase in snowfall during the winter months. Is that a possibility?
Absolutely.
Despite the temperature rising?
Absolutely, yes. I would think, and this is predicted. I mean, I think maybe a 2% increase in the snow, but also 2% increase in the summer heat. That's not mutually exclusive. But imagine that some places are saying, hey, great, we've been cold for so long that maybe this is going to be kind of fun for the next 50 years. We'll be warmer. And, you know, beachfront property might happen by be in Tennessee. So, but we know we're not going to, I mean, it looks like we're the intrusion of salt water into, say, all our coastal zones is going to wreak havoc with the plant life and with the, recreational opportunities that we all seem to enjoy. And many major cities, mega cities, are built near the coastline all over the world. Now, in the United States, I mean, you know, we sort of have the money to respond to some of this, but we're talking about places that are very poor, that for whom a change in a dramatic weather events will mean loss of life in millions, in large numbers. And so people are talking about anticipating environmental refugees and mass migrations because of big weather events. I mean, just the tsunamis that we saw in Southeast Asia show us what environmental refugees means.
The economic impact sounds overwhelming, even for a country like the United States that almost has infinite wealth. I've heard stories as of late in Scandinavia or somewhere in Northern Europe where they're even covering some local glaciers near ski resorts with aluminum foil or some other reflective substance just to protect that economic activity. What possibly could the United States do, even with its resources, to control the weather or to mitigate this huge change?
Well, you said a word that, you know, floats around a lot, mitigation. Some people, I mean, there are only two things that we're going to be able to do, adaptation, to adapt to it, and the other is to try and mitigate the negative consequences. Some people talk about buying cars with, you know, very high, large tires so that in the flooded areas you can still drive. But if we really were serious about trying to mitigate these consequences, we would need to reduce our carbon emissions. And that means that we need to, in some places, take seriously opportunities for energy efficiency. But also, of course, renewable energy options need to be implemented. But I think pretty much, you know, the United States' per capita CO2 emissions is responsible for about 23% of the world's CO2 emissions, and we have about 5% of the population. So we've got so much room to reduce that. And what we do makes such a big difference that today there are 2 billion people on the earth that do not have electricity and who want it. Now, how they get electricity, if they get it, it's very smart to go with solar panels and hydrogen power and wind power and the like, but it's not very good to go with dirty coal. And so in the United States, it's hard. You say I've been out of the country, but I've been all over the world in this. This is a global carbon project. It's not a Japanese project. It's just the Japanese government in its National Institute for Environmental Studies has sponsoring approach of trying to bring the sciences together to give the best scientific products to decision makers. The United States is not very popular around the world for its almost ostrich-like behavior and denial of this problem.
So the Bush administration isn't taking this as seriously as Japan or world governments or the scientific community would like. Why is it? How do you see the scenario here in this country? Why were the ostrich?
Well, I guess it's a combination of things, some of which are very hard for me to understand. But I do know that the carbon interests of the president and the vice president are very deep and long and cherished interests.
But yet there's this threatening economic problem in the future. Certainly they'd be cognizant of that, being the business people that they are.
Well, yeah, I grew up thinking that America could roll up its sleeves and solve any problem. And the position that it would hurt our economy so much to respond to this challenge is not only false, because we now know that businesses who are doing energy efficiency and also mitigation and the like are are not suffering economically. I know that businesses say they want regulation and they just like to have a certain playing field. So I really cannot understand the myopic behavior. And there is no country in the world that is losing more respect for its position on this than the United States, which of course makes me ashamed and sorry. Now, Australia is the only country that I think is espousing the same rhetoric that the United States is.
And this is something you can feel at conferences and that you've experienced in your work and your emails and exchanges.
Oh, yes. And at conferences when I give talks and other talks, I mean, it's essentially the major topic. What is it that we would have to do? What is the question that the United States needs answered to see its way to leadership rather than, and in fact, losing a lot of opportunities in the renewable energy and transformation of industry and transportation, losing our edge because we are so dug into this position. So it's very hard to explain, and I certainly can't try to explain my president and vice president.
How quickly could the problem be reversed if the United States decided to cooperate and the whole world community was on the same page as far as carbon emissions and reducing that? How quickly would this turn around? How quickly could we slow the rate of temperature increase?
Well, you've asked a couple different questions, so I'll have to tease out. That because of the long life of carbon dioxide, we've already put up into the atmosphere enough to have to present us with problems for the next 50-100 years. So unless we got so serious that we stopped all fossil fuels right now, we would still have the problem for the next 7,500 years. There's no doubt. And the question, the big question is, when do we stop? When do we get serious enough that the level of heat, or the global the greenhouse gas effect, is tolerable? They're thinking now we have about 370 parts per million. That's the carbon concentration in the atmosphere. And to stabilize the temperature so that it would only rise about a 1 degree centigrade per decade over the next 100 years, we would have to cut our emissions by about, 60 to 70% today, if not more. I'm not positive of that. But the issue is, if we keep on waiting, then the pullback is going to be even greater to not have catastrophe. So it's kind of like a path. Do you put a new roof on your house or not? You keep on letting the roof get a little bit larger, and then eventually you don't have a roof anymore, and then you don't have a home anymore, etc.
But even beyond that, the catastrophe could be greater than just the demise of, not to be overly dramatic here, human civilization, but countless species and habitat and ocean wildlife.
Well, that's already happened. That's already happening. And in one respect, I'd like to just cover the notion that some species are more adaptable. You talked about adaptation and mitigation. Some species can move. Certainly the human species can move. We're the most adaptable of all. But some species can move. Trees, the maple tree will move, say, more to colder climes over a long period of time. But the predators, or the natural balance of the web of life of that ecosystem, some of the species won't move with them. So we have the added little problem of a new maybe other new species getting into a different relationship in the web, so that we don't have not the same predictable checks and balances. So we have some disease vectors that are getting to be very serious, and malaria is breaking out again, and dengue fever, which is just a horrible disease, smallpox. I mean, just very many things that we are now going to be having to worry about. And so we're not going to reverse it. That's the bad news. But we do have, and I say American ingenuity, we do have the ability to anticipate and act wisely right now. But we do know in this Amsterdam Declaration of 2001 that I mentioned previously, the sciences said, we are united in saying to you, the business as usual path is not viable. It is not life supporting. We must not continue on this path in terms of carbon emissions.
Apparently our government is not getting this message or refuses to pay attention to it, but how about Joe and Jane Sixpack, as it were? Is the message getting out? Is the average person in the street, especially in this country, more aware of the issue? Are they concerned?
Well, you know, saying our government is that's a big concept. Some in our government, and unfortunately in the administration, are not leaders. In fact, they are holding us back. But in other parts of the government, in our national laboratories, in the scientific community, the millions of scientists that work for the national government and across our public universities and in our non-governmental organizations and in our state and local governments and our regional compacts, these people are, I would call them the beauty of the grassroots of our country. The amount of awareness is very high, and in fact, you may have seen that some more than 130 mayors across the United States just signed their version of the Kyoto Protocol recently. And I think there's a compact of New England states that are challenging, a compact is challenging the Bush administration's failure to lead in this area. And so there's, now, Jane and Joe Sixpack, or Mary and Bruce Cabernet Sauvignon, whoever out there, I think that there's a real angst and sort of a denial. It's hard to say, I'm so worried about a problem that my president says isn't a problem. Or another a way to handle it is, if it's so bad, then why don't I just go out and party? Or if there's nothing that can be done, then give it up. Let it go. You know, it's too overwhelming a problem. I personally am not very optimistic about the long term, but I'm sure that I want to do everything I can for the short term. And by that, I'm talking about my daughter and her children. And those are people I love. And to make most of the public dollars that we do collect and spend collectively, to make most of that be about responding to catastrophe is not what I'd like to do. I'd rather be spreading it around for education or the arts or literature or, you know, be having a good time. But increasingly, our money's going to be having to be spent in repairing of roads and bridges and coastline. I mean, the amount of money, of the beautiful beaches in California, those are all what I think are called beach nourishment projects. The beach is so eroded in California that they're spending increasing amounts of money just to add more and more beach to because of the erosion. Now, if we're right that severe storms are going to eat away at that at a faster rate, then there's not even going to be a long enough period to re-nourish the beach with sand. So, I mean, these are little examples. I mean, there are just millions. And let me also suggest there are thousands of websites on global warming, climate change that are very credible. The US EPA's global warming, or for businesses, the the Pew Center for Climate Change, that's the PEW Center for Climate Change, which is making alliance, which is making the public aware of tremendous business leadership, and the insurance industry is very interested in climate change and global warming. Of course, they have to insure us and our insurance rates, and the Pentagon is very aware of global warming and climate change. The transportation airline industry are very aware. Climatologists. I mean, it's hard to find a group of people that's not aware. And even the backyard gardener knows that weather conditions have changed and climate patterns are an issue for them. Now, whether or not an individual wants to make a big change. A lot of us feel, I can't do anything. But what does one person make a difference? But it turns out that it's only one person by one person that makes the situation as it is today. So I would suggest that it's in every aspect of your life, you think about the carbon emissions. You think about the energy impact of your life. Every airplane ride, every car trip, every refrigerator door open. I mean, I throw an old dry towel into the dryer if I use my dryer, and it cuts down the amount of time that I dry my clothes. I close closet doors, you know, to keep from having to heat those in the winter. There are just a million little things. And if for example, compact fluorescent light bulbs. I mean, you know, these are the fun, easy fruit, as they say. But if we all could seriously reduce by 10% over last year's or over last month's use, it would be a tremendous collective contribution. And 10% is really literally nothing. And so we can do that. We are strong, and we are strong together, and we can also support our local leaders who are having to respond to the local conditions in our own regions, and we can support those who are speaking out and trying to do some innovative things so that they're not left out by themselves, to push our national leadership, just as these mayors have across the country and the New England states have. They're very aware of the risks to local life and local commerce and industry if all of this, or when and as all of this is happening. They need our support.
In the few remaining moments that we have left, let's talk a bit about the Global Carbon Project and the work you've been doing in Japan.
Oh, great. The Global Carbon Project is sponsored by these four international scientific communities. We call them the IHDP, the IGBP, WCRP, and Diversitas. And our job is, and I'm the Human Dimensions Office for the world, for this Global Carbon Project. And we have another office in Canberra, Australia. And together, ours is to do the best we can to galvanize the scientific community of the world to make policy-relevant science on the global carbon cycle for decision-makers at every level. In the SCUBA office, which is is located in the science city of Japan, SCUBA is the science city, we're focusing on regional carbon management and trying to find how to bring down global carbon cycle science down to the regional level so that people where they live will have the data they need to make decisions at the regional level.
What's the best way for people to learn more about the Global Carbon Project or even to contact you?
Www.globalcarbonproject.org. That's all one word, globalcarbonproject.org. And I'm on that all the time, and they can read all about the carbon cycle and the Earth System Science Partnership of the world science communities.
Dr. Penelope Kanaan, I want to thank you so much for joining us at KGNU today.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Penelope Kanaan, environmental sociologist at Denver University's Department of Sociology and Criminology. For KGNU, I'm Roger Wendell.